Turn please to Exodus 17 and verses 1 to 7. Exodus 17. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they contended or quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, "Why did you bring us out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?" And Moses cried out to the Lord, "What am I to do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me." The Lord answered Moses, "Walk on ahead of the people. Take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. I will stand there before you on the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink." So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the place Massah and Meribah, because the Israelites quarreled, because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" I think this passage, the water from the rock passage, is one of the most extraordinary passages of the Old Testament. And if we grasp something of the significance of what's happening here, then we will be shocked and thrilled and overawed this evening by what is unfolding. I don't simply mean by the miracle itself, though the miracle is quite amazing, as miracles tend to be, but the thing surrounding the miracle. Who is standing where? Who is holding what? Who is saying what? Doing what? So let's first of all just set the scene and get a bit of context here. As far as the location is concerned, Israel have left Egypt, crossed the Red Sea, and they've been heading southwards down into the Sinai Peninsula, stage by stage, as the Lord has led them. And finally, they are almost at Mount Sinai, or Mount Horeb itself. This place, Rephidim, according to the map in the back of my Bible, which isn't inspired, I know, and they do have a little guess as to where places were, but Rephidim and Horeb are right next to each other. Rephidim and Sinai, I guess. If Rephidim, where Israel are camped, is Netley, then Sinai is going to be somewhere over in West End or Town Hill Park or something like that. You should always think of Town Hill Park as Sinai now. It's close. It's a walking distance away. And it's really important where they've almost got to at Sinai. Because although they're still at the beginning of their journey, they're a few months into a 40-year journey. That's a long journey. If we were finishing that journey today, it would have started on the 22nd of September 1973. I was six then. A long, long, long time ago. And although we're only just a tiny bit into this journey, as far as Moses is concerned, we are virtually at the most significant part of the journey. There's the end of the journey when they get to Canaan, which is really, really important. But for Moses, the first most important part of the journey is when he gets Israel to Sinai, to the mountain. You see, when God had called him from this very wilderness, from this very mountain, a few months earlier and told him to go back and lead his people out, the sign that God had given him that his mission would have been a success was that all Israel would gather together at Sinai to worship him. So getting the people from Egypt to this mountain next to Rephidim is clearly of critical importance as far as Moses is concerned. Something is going to happen at Sinai. It's one of the goals of the journey. A covenant is going to be made with the people. God is going to show himself in a powerful way. And yet, here they are at Netli, or Rephidim, with just a few 100 meters still to go, a couple of kilometers to go to get to Sinai. An absolute disaster strikes. For the third time in as many chapters, a crisis envelops Israel. And they get so taken up with their problem, they can't see anything else apart from their problem, and they want someone to pay. They want somebody to blame. Like the first problem at the end of chapter 15, the Mara incident, this crisis concerns a lack of water, which is a serious problem to have when you're deep in the midst of a wilderness, especially one as dry as the Sinai Peninsula. Now, when I just took you through 15, 16, and 17 at the beginning, I showed you how at each point God was testing Israel, yeah? These things that happened to Israel, these water and food shortages, they weren't accidents. It wasn't that God's logistics were slightly held up. This was planned by God, out of his goodness, under his loving, watchful supervision, to bring about good for Israel. It would become an opportunity for them to exercise faith and demonstrate their obedience in the midst of a testing time. It was an opportunity for faith to jump out of the classroom and start getting exercised in the real world. It would become an opportunity for the power and the majesty and glory of God to be displayed to them. And Israel should have been thinking theologically at this point. They should have been thinking, well, look, we haven't got any water here at Rephidim, but God has brought us out of Egypt. He has displayed incredible power when he smashed the Egyptians. He's opened up the Red Sea for us. We crossed on dry land. Now, we got across there and we did slip up a bit. We began to grumble when we got to Mara because the water was bitter. But God was patient with us and he was good to us. And we learned the lesson. God will always come through with his promises. Except we didn't quite get the lesson, did we? Because we went on into the wilderness and we got hungry and we started to say, where's the bread, God? Will you please give us bread? You brought us out here to kill us, have you? And then God showed that he was faithful to his promises and he started to rain bread down every night on them. But they should have been thinking, we've seen the power of God, we've crossed the Red Sea, we've seen his goodness to us at Mara, we've seen his goodness to us in the manna that he gives us every night. What is God going to do today for us? He wants us here for a reason. He's led us out. How is God going to supply our needs here at Rephidim? Their past, their experience, more importantly, God's word insists that he won't fail. So why should today be the occasion when God does fail? Why should this crisis be the one that dethrones God? But sadly, that's not how Israel reasoned. Sadly, that's often how we don't think. Too often we fail the tests. We end up turning on God and testing God. Chapter 17 is full of this testing language. Chapters 15 and 16, who is testing who? 15 and 16, God is testing Israel. Chapter 17, who's testing who? Israel now testing God. And they've turned this completely round. Verse 2 and verse 7. Man is beginning to test the Lord. At the end of verse 7, we're given an insight into this testing. This is what they're saying. Is the Lord among us or not? Israel are saying to God, you don't care, do you? Actually, God, you're not even here. And you're not listening to us. And you don't help. The psalmist reflects on this time and describes Israel as limiting God. and they begin to doubt him. They begin to say he can't do it. He's not here. But at the same time, while they're doubting him, they're also making an accusation against God. And this is really important. And I want to go through this quite slowly so I get this right in my own mind. Israel are doing two things. One, they are saying God is not here, verse 7b. But also they are blaming God for their misfortune. Admittedly, this is directed at Moses, but it's ultimately God who's being accused by Israel of gross neglect, of callousness, and wickedness. They are accusing God of total dereliction of all of his duties. I want you to notice how that word quarrel or contend is used alongside the word test, both in verses 2 and verse 7. It's not just testing, it's contending. And I prefer the New King James Version's contention than the NIV's or ESV's quarrel. A quarrel, in my experience, from my childhood, was something that usually sprang up quite sporadically from something that was fairly insignificant. My sister and I being told to do the drying up. And we started to quarrel as to whose turn it was. And things began to escalate. My sister's infamous nails came out and were dug into my arm. A recorder maybe was snatched by me and brandished in the vicinity of her head. And things began to grow and grow. And then Dad would come in because he had the biggest voice and would shout the loudest, and the quarrel would disappear. It was something fairly unstructured over something quite insignificant. Whereas a contention, on the other hand, speaks of a very specific and serious complaint that one person has got against another. And in this context, in chapter 17, the complaint, the contention, is pursued in a really structured way. And the Hebrew word that NIV has translated quarrel, I prefer contention, is a legal word. This is what Ed Clowney has to say. Unfortunately, the word quarrel does not adequately express the meaning of the Hebrew term. They lodged a complaint with Moses would be closer to the meaning. This is a legal term describing the institution of a lawsuit. In the prophets, it's used to express the lawsuit that God would bring against Israel because they'd broken his covenant. You get that in, say, Micah. Studying that a year or so ago, saw in chapter 6 that God calls on the mountains as his witnesses to his indictment, his contention that he has against his people. He brings a case against his people. He puts his people in the dock because they've smashed and shattered his covenant. But what's happening at Meribah? Who is bringing a lawsuit against who? Help. The Israelites are bringing the lawsuit against God. They are trying to put God in the dock. For sure, Moses is the one who's getting all of the abuse. But if Moses, God's prophet, God's representative, is indicted, then so too, much more so, is the Lord. And what we've got then in chapter 17, it's not just a little bit of grumbling going on, as is quite often the case in Israel. We haven't got a few loose cannons just firing off complaints against Moses. But at the foothill of Sinai, Israel have turned on the Lord, and they want to stone his representative, his prophet. And it's not simply an act of mob violence. They're already in the midst of legal proceedings. They found Moses guilty of leading them to their death. And he is going to be the first to die because they can't kill God. They're going to kill God's representative, his prophet. Oh, this is terrible. What is happening here? We tremble as we wonder what furious power will break out at Meribah. Not from Israel, but from God. What is God going to do to a people who are trying to put him in the dock? They brought legal proceedings against him. And suddenly the Lord speaks to Moses. And the language, the imagery of the courtroom begins to intensify. Verse 5, and the Lord said to Moses, pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Suddenly we've got witnesses, the elders. We've got a judge, Moses, whom the Lord has placed not in the dock, but rather over these legal proceedings. And in his hand, God has put the staff. And in case we miss the significance of this, he reminds us that this is the staff that struck the Nile. What was that all about? Well, that was the beginning of God's judgment against Egypt. The first plague, he was to stretch out his staff against the water, and the water was turned to blood. Judgment was coming via Moses' staff. It was God's scepter in Moses' hand. And for most of the other plagues that follow, the staff is raised against Egypt. Well, now that rod, that staff of holy, fiery, awesome judgment is in Moses' hand. The witnesses are all there. Moses is told to go away from Israel a bit. You know what's going to happen next, don't you? Well, you would assume you would know what's going to happen next. He's going to go a little way up onto the mountain, and he's going to turn round with God's rod of judgment, with all Israel before him, and he's going to go kazam. And the people are going to be obliterated, because God will not be put in the dock. That's what they deserve. That would make sense. Possibly it's what Moses is expecting. But it isn't what happened. At the instruction of God, Moses does raise the staff. But he doesn't hit Israel. And what happens is, I think, one of the most amazing incidents of the Old Testament. God had said, behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, water shall come out of it, and the people shall drink. One of the commentaries that I was reading when I was prepping this just left me so dissatisfied. I threw it across the room nearly. It's one of my favourite commentaries on Exodus. It's John Currid's one. And he says, the point of this story is to demonstrate, if need be, that God will go to great and miraculous lengths to provide for the Hebrews. And I just think, no, God's done much more than that here. It's not just showing how far God will go to give them water. We've got legal language here. We've got a courtroom scene here. We've got a rod of judgment in Moses' hand. We've got a rock being smashed. We've got Moses being told off 4 decades later when he smashes the rock the second time, when he should have spoken to it. There's something awesome, mysterious about this. I don't just see water coming out to Israel. I see salvation coming out. Well, for sure, water flows to them, but it's a picture of something much, much bigger. Look at it again. God says, I will stand before you. Think of that in legal terms again. Who stands before the judge? The guilty person does. God says, I'll stand before you. Men should stand before God. But here, he stands before the one who is holding the scepter. Again, to quote Ed Clowney, before the face of Moses the judge, with his rod lifted up, stands the God of Israel. The Lord stands in the prisoner's dock. Moses cannot strike into the heart of God's Shekinah glory, so God commands that he strike the rock, but the rock is identified with God. How God stood on the rock, I don't know. It could have been that the cloud, which in the wilderness was the sign of his presence, came and enveloped the rock. Could have been. Or it could have been one of those occasions in the Old Testament where the Son of God appears as a man, we call them theophanies, and literally stood on the rock before them. But the really important thing is that this rock is not just any rock. This rock is God's rock. And it's identified with God. And when the rock is struck, God is being struck. This rock picture becomes such an important part in the Old Testament description of the Messiah. Moses would never forget this incident. We sang part two of the Song of Moses a few moments ago at the beginning of our third hymn, beginning of the sermon. And part one, of course, is Exodus 15. Part two of Moses' song is Deuteronomy 32. And he says, I proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God. He is the rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are justice. The God of truth and without injustice, righteous and upright is he. And in that song, God is identified as the rock on no less than five occasions. Psalm 78, which commemorates the Exodus incident, says in verse 35, they remembered that God was their rock and the Most High God their Redeemer. Psalm 95, come, let us sing to the Lord, let us shout joyfully to the rock of our salvation. Sorry if I'm laboring this point, but when Moses hit the rock, he didn't just whack the side of a mountain. He was striking to the heart of God. God is identified with that rock. These aren't my fanciful dreamings. Listen to what Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 to 4. I want you to know, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud. They all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food, the manna. They all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them. And that rock was Christ. The Lord is standing on the rock here for the one who carries the judgment rock. It's a picture. A great graphic picture of what is going to happen next. As we were reading this for the first time, who are reading the Bible for the first time and understanding what was happening, we will be thinking, what is he doing here? Israel should be stood before the judge. And yet God is standing in the place of the accused. And Moses lifts the rod and he strikes the rock. Christ, the rock. Is God then guilty? Certainly not. It's the people who are guilty. They've rebelled against God and they've rejected God. And yet what this is teaching us is that God bears the judgment and receives the blow that their rebellion deserved, that the blessing and the life and the salvation might pour out of God to them. It's one of the most shocking demonstrations that salvation is all of grace. We're the guilty ones. We deserve the rod of judgment. Yet God pays the price. He gets what we deserve to give us what we didn't deserve. And it's out of God that salvation and grace and life and love flows. The same God in our humanity in Jerusalem a few thousand years later would cry, if anybody is thirsty, let him come to me. Drink, and out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. What Moses did was strike a rock that was a picture of Jesus. Later on, the scene would not be rehearsed, it would be acted out. in all of its reality and power. And then it wouldn't be Moses standing with the rod. It would be the Father. And it wouldn't be a rock that was ahead of the one holding the rod. It was his Son. And it wasn't a rock that was smashed. It was the body of our Lord Jesus Christ, which was broken for us. His blood was poured out for us, that we might be set free and saved. Who is this God who does this for the guilty? Who is this God who does this for the people who want to put him in the dock and reject him and moan about him and complain about him constantly? Well, he's the God of kindness and grace, who's full of loving kindness and mercy and patience and covenant love. The God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, who together would rather pay the cost so that they can give the salvation freely to us and have us bear what we deserve forever and ever. Have you come to him? Are you trusting him? To have God stand against you and lift the rod of judgment would be so terrifying. Israel didn't know what they were doing, getting into an argument with God. You don't have to be. Because Jesus, God's loving, eternal Son, has offered to take your place, your punishment, and pour out his grace, his righteousness, and his love onto you, and set you free. And all he asks from you is that you give him everything. Not all your cash, or all your possessions. He wants you as a person. He wants your trust. He wants your faith. He wants your love. And he gives you everything and extends it to you in the gospel. If our understanding of this passage is correct, and I believe it is, that's why I've spent 25 minutes saying that, well, I think it is, but if it is correct and it's a picture of Calvary and the striking of the Son of God, then no wonder Moses was judged so severely for striking the rock a second time when he was told to speak to it. In Numbers 20, verses 7 to 13. Only once at his appointed time does God bear the stroke of our doom. The people had cried in accusation of unbelief. Is the Lord among us or not? Well, God shows them, yes, he's among them. He's among them in a way that they could not have imagined. There he stood upon the rock, not only among them, but in their place, bearing their condemnation. Before God gave the covenant at Sinai, he pledged his presence at Calvary. Before God ratified the old covenant, he gave us another assurance of the new covenant, which, interestingly, is older than the old covenant. As it comes first. It's the one given to Adam, and it's the one given to Abraham, that God would come and bless all the nations of this world through Jesus Christ his Son, and all who turn to him will be saved. And the new covenant says God will be your God, and you can be his son or daughter as you come to God in Jesus, who's done all this for you.